Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Better than I'm doing.
Really? You're not doing well.
I'm brain dead. I was in Washington. I came back today. Didn't get any sleep last night. And so if you ever hope to win an argument against me, and I've always maintained that that's something that could happen conceivably today, I would say today's your day. Because I am...
Well, I feel pretty stupid myself, so it's probably going to be highly entertaining. Maybe if people play it fast enough, we'll see.
But I'm also underinformed. I've been so swamped by blogging head stuff. All I've... My contact with the news has consisted essentially of just listening to blogging heads. So everything analytical I say about anything topical will be something I've heard somebody say on blogging heads already, okay?
That's pretty bad.
Hey, I wouldn't say that's bad. I would say derivative, but richly derivative.
Were you at the Atlantic party, the worst party ever?
No, I read your account of that. What does it mean that I didn't get invited to that darn thing, much less get invited up on stage? Now explain this social hierarchy.
This was a party the Atlantic had, and it does seem sort of eerily resonant with David, the philosophy of the owner of the Atlantic, to gather the best and the brightest in one spot. He had a party, and the people who were actually invited to the party were partying on stage while anybody else could wander in and watch them party from the audience.
Watch so there was the elites party.
Right. So
And I didn't even get invited to be one of the one watching the elites is what I'm saying. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, that's probably better, actually. Better not to be invited at all, probably. But anyway, so there was this sort of class divide between the people on stage who got drink and food and the people in the audience who just sort of had to watch their betters have drink and food, including some people who were like writers who had written for The Atlantic and couldn't get on stage and who blogged hilariously about it. Anyway,
I've got to say, your description of it makes it sound like an extremely bad idea, but...
Everybody agreed it was a bad idea. It's been roundly denounced. But there's sort of a valuable lesson in it, which is you can see what their thought process was. The thought process was, well, we're going to have this party and we're only going to invite, 100 or so people. But we want to do something for everybody else, so we'll let them come and watch, and that's better than nothing, right? Well, it turns out it's not better than nothing, because not only are they pissed off, but it makes the people who are invited and are on stage feel incredibly uncomfortable. So it's sort of proof that people really do value, I think, social equality. And
it's proof, but I don't think this is a case where you really needed to do the experiment to establish that this was a bad idea.
Well, it's odd. The libertarian blogs have attacked me, saying, well, let's ask the people who are in the audience. Maybe they would rather have half a loaf than the whole loaf. Maybe they enjoyed sitting and watching rich people cavort. And that is the libertarian position. The libertarian position is...
If they don't like it, they don't have to come. But did they all know what they were in for?
Right, but the libertarian position is open borders. We will have cities with wild class distinctions. But people will, that's better than nothing because people don't really mind social inequality.
I knew this would all come back to immigration eventually.
This party was a synecdoche for the world that we would get if we had open borders. Not to invite people and have everybody who is invited be an equal. That is the deep, resonant, profound lesson of the Atlantic Party debacle.
Yep, I was pretty sure there was an immigration lesson in there somewhere. Thanks for getting to that, Mickey.
But the people in the audience, I don't know if they knew what they were getting. That's a very good question.
I think that's the key question. If they did, if the invitation said, second class seating,
no,
and they bought into it, then they have only themselves to blame.
Well, it would still make life uncomfortable for the people who were invited. That's the key point.
Both of them should have had transparency. If the invitations were not transparent, then...
Well, but transparency doesn't mean it's a good thing. You could have a transparent invitation to a fascist police state. And, hey, everybody who takes it will be happy, but that doesn't mean you should have a fascist
No, transparency doesn't justify everything, but I would say this kind of thing, if everybody knew what they were in for, I don't think it's a horrible idea, is what I would say. I think it's a horrible idea if people got there and discovered that, the important people
Bob,
are on
I
stage.
I can't believe you don't think it's a horrible idea. Would you ever give a party like that? Why?
No, I wouldn't give one.
Well, it's a horrible idea, that's why.
Okay, you win. See, I told you would win an argument. This is what happens
there
when
you
I don't get sleep.
That's one, man.
Oh, man. This is...
Okay. Okay.
This could
Let's
be a debacle.
The route.
But you know what? While I wasn't at the Atlantic Party, you know, I did have a little contact with, you know, the occasional celebrity. You know who I had breakfast with this morning in Washington? Go ahead.
Robert De Niro.
No, but I actually yesterday in Washington I had coffee with Mike Tomasky, who, according to our commenters, looks like Robert De Niro. I actually think he looks like a cross between Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman, but I digress. This morning I had breakfast with Gary Hart, whom you'll now ridicule just because I had breakfast with him. I know, Mickey. But who did you have breakfast with?
I didn't have breakfast.
Okay.
But this is my breakfast. I'm having breakfast with you.
Okay.
But I actually do think Gary Hart is sort of a sad and tragic case.
No. Why? Because he's not president?
Well, he pioneered neoliberalism. So by all accounts, he should be president.
He should be.
He paved the way for Bill Clinton. He had a very minor, in the scheme of things, sexual scandal, and you know, given what's happened since. And somehow this prevented him from even having like a heavy-duty you know, responsible job in the Clinton administration, because Clinton didn't want to be tarred with Gary Hart's sexual peccadilloes, which is pretty funny. And he's sort of forgotten where he came from. He's drifted off into sort of very sort of strident sort of left-wing rhetoric. And
on domestic policy or on foreign policy?
On both. He said we were going to lose our – we said we were in danger of losing our army in Iraq. I don't think we're in danger of losing our army in Iraq. I think if we have to fight our way out,
well,
we can fight our way out.
Well, it's been neutralized. I mean, it may perhaps in some ways fortunately that we can't afford to launch an invasion of Iran. But
no, he said in Iraq our army was going to be trapped and killed.
Oh, I would like to see that. I would like to see you dig up that quote.
I heard it in the Huffington Post. I'll link to it. I heard him say it in person.
Okay. Well, anyway, I really wouldn't mind.
He was just looking for something to say that would get attention.
I really wouldn't mind having a presidential candidate on the Democratic side who had his combination of brains and thoughtfulness and rhetorical skill. Not that the crowd is really shallow in that regard, but
he's a smart guy. But I deny that he has tremendous rhetorical skills.
I mean, kind of, I'm not talking about oratorical so much as conversational, and I mean, it gives you the impression of being a really smart person who's really thinking about the issues.
But a deeply flawed character, unfortunately.
Well, no, as you just said yourself, his sin was actually a minor one. He had the misfortune of...
Oh, but that's not the weirdness. It's sort of even weirder that he stayed married to his wife after all this.
What are you talking about? That happens all the time.
But in his case, it's somehow creepy. I'm sorry.
Happens all the time that men have affairs and stay married, Mickey.
Well, you have to know Hart's special case. I'm sorry. It seems. I agree. It's weirder than the average run-of-the-mill situations you describe.
I don't know.
He's just a weird guy. He struck everybody in that campaign as somehow odd, and that's why he's not president.
No. The reason he's not president is because the rules were changed on his watch. It had always been the case that your personal life was your personal life, and then all of a sudden, I think it was the Miami Herald decided to send reporters to follow him.
Well, after he taught at them. Bob.
No, actually not. I didn't discuss this with him, but as I recall, the article in which. He was quoted as saying in a New York Times Magazine piece, you can follow me and you'll find it's very boring, but the following had started before that. Those were unrelated. That's a common misconception that he taunted them and the response was to follow him.
But he made the mistake of taunting them as they were following them, which...
Yeah, that's a big mistake.
Probably a big mistake. I don't know. It's his ego seems too fragile and obviously close to the surface and behind everything. Obviously, everybody's ego is the same way, but...
Yeah, I don't know, man. Did I predict that you would belittle him as soon as you heard that he had breakfast with me?
I thought it was going to be a celebrity like Michael Tomasky.
Well.
But, no, I mean, I just, I don't know. The conversation wasn't excruciating?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Like I said, smart guy, wouldn't mind having a presidential candidate like that.
There is a lack of the perfect presidential candidate.
There is, but we'll get to that.
Which is a segue.
Are we going to get to that first?
I think that was first on our list, yeah.
Okay. Obama.
Well, Obama always seemed to me to have the potential to be the black Gary Hart. the ideal type of Gary Hart, not the
Wait,
real
Nick,
Gary
have
Hart.
You thought that before?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, sure. Because
you are smooth, man.
He can, you know, we all want a Gary Hart who the idealized version of Gary Hart, which is, you know, a guy who is willing to disdain Democratic interest groups yet pursue Democratic goals like national health care and a leaner, meaner defense and all the things that Gary Hart stood for. And, you know, that person will appeal mainly to yuppies, not so much to unions, but yuppies are, they're more and more yuppies and fewer unions, so that shouldn't hurt the Democrats. He'd appeal to a lot of Republicans. He would be sort of arid and intellectual and not, you know, people would say, well, he doesn't have the fresh, flesh-pressing skills of a Bill Richardson. Well, so what? And all those things sort of applied to Obama. He was not that popular with hardcore Democrats. He's very popular with rich yuppies. So he is sort of the demographically the black Gary Hart. And I keep waiting for him to do the Gary Hart thing of pissing off Democratic interest groups. And he did a tiny, 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 tiny bit of it. But he gave this...
At the speech in Iowa, you mean?
No, he didn't do any of it at the speech in Iowa.
The influential Iowa columnist said he did.
Didn't he say he came out for merit pay at one point, and which is sort of at a teachers union convention, which is mildly heretical, although a lot of teachers unions are coming around to merit pay because it means more money. If he'd said he was for firing incompetent teachers, that really would have been a diss to them, but he didn't say that. He went to Detroit and told them they should build higher mileage cars. Well, that's not really pissing off a Democratic interest group, is it? So he gave a speech that's been wildly hailed. It's like the greatest thing since the Gettysburg Address. Chris Matthews was, you know, we hear echoes of Martin Luther King and John Kennedy, and it was this brilliant address that was going to turn the race around and cause him to win Iowa. And then you read the speech, and it's actually a very, very skillfully done speech. It actually reads better than hearing him say it, because when he talks, he's sort of a little stuck up, I find, Obama.
Some people have that reaction.
And he sticks his chin out and he says, "This will not do," you know? He's like, you know.
I don't get. Some people say he talks too much about himself. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that too. But anyway, it's very well done, because it does three things simultaneously. One, it portrays him as the real hardcore Democrat. We don't have to compromise. You know, we want a real Democrat, not a Hillary Clinton half Democrat. Second, at the same time, he portrays himself as a bipartisan bridge builder. And the third, he portrays himself as a truth teller, willing to give bitter medicine to tell the people what they need to hear, not what they want to hear. I think those things are in large part contradictory. If you want to be a bipartisan bridge builder, you're not going to have be the hardcore true Democrat. You're going to have to do a little triangulating, and he didn't tell the Democrats anything they didn't want to hear. The things that the public doesn't want to hear are all things the Democrats in the primaries want to hear.
No, but
like
those
we
two
have
things,
to raise taxes.
Those two things aren't contradictory. I mean, I have your blog post here making that assertion that on the one hand he quote is against triangulating and poll driven positions. And on the other hand, he portrays himself as a bipartisan bridge builder. I think those are two different things. I mean, the triangulation poll driven he's saying he's against having your opinion, your positions set by public opinion polling, okay? To be a bipartisan bridge builder is to take your opinion, your position, however you've arrived at it, and in order to realize it in and make it public policy, you know, make those compromises you have to make to do business with the other side and get some semblance of what you want done. Yeah. Those are two separate questions, you arrive at the positions and how you realize them as nearly as you can.
I guess I'm playing the welfare reform model, as I so often do. the welfare reform position Bill Clinton came up with was not a traditional Democratic position. It was a triangulating position, by which one means not poll-tested, but it was distancing himself from both the Republicans, who didn't want to spend money on Democrats, on welfare recipients, and the Democrats, who didn't want to make welfare recipients work. He took a position above those two. That is the essence of triangulation. That is not what Obama is doing. Obama is saying, I am for the core Democratic position in welfare. That would be, don't make recipients work, give them money.
Okay, run that by me again, though, because I've actually always been confused about the actual origin of the term triangulation. I mean, I know it has this connotation of kind of cynically arriving at something that amounts to some kind of compromise, but what is it again?
I think it's a Dick Morris term for how Bill Clinton distinguished himself from the Democratic Congress on the one hand and the Republican opposition on the other by standing above them both and opposing both of them. So on welfare, the Democratic Congress didn't want to reform welfare by making recipients work, and the Republicans didn't want to spend money. Bill Clinton occupied a third position
where
he said he did want to make them work, but he was willing to spend money to make them work.
Okay, so in one sense, it's the opposite of saying to two groups, I've got something for both of you, right? It's like saying, I'm not either of you.
Yeah.
And yet, isn't that essentially a rhetorical difference? I mean, couldn't you take the position he took and point to the commonality it has with each of the two groups?
You could do that, but it was politically it.
So it's a rhetorical thing. Triangulation doesn't refer to the position you've arrived at.
Well, in order to take that position, you have to be negative with the Democrats, and the Democrats were not going to fall for position. Well, I'm with you, Democrats. I'm for half of what you want. I'm willing to spend more. I just want to make welfare recipients work. They wouldn't have bought that. That's not an appeal to compromise that would have brought them to the table. You sort of have to stiff arm them and say, no, Democrats, you're wrong. Welfare recipients should work.
Well, then, by that definition, Obama can say he's against triangulation and he is for bridge building. You're saying they are two different things.
That's a good point. I'm on the verge of losing this argument.
Would you like us to stop the tape and give you an hour or so, Mickey?
That would be helpful.
You just used 10 seconds.
Well, it seems to me that the solutions like welfare require not bridge building, but require actual triangulation, require actual stiff arming of both parties. It's not just a question of sitting down with a loaf and cutting it in half.
No. Seems to me the fundamental difference is if the country is in a mood where you want to run against Washington, you say, look, what I want is, you point to what's the difference between what you want and what the basic Washington groups want. And if it's not in that mood, you point to the commonality. I really don't see the difference. But it seems to me rhetorical. But
a classic example is education. The problem is that the key barriers that stand in the way of reform are not the marginal demands of the Democrats. In other words, it's not like you're taking away the last 10%, but they get 90%.
Mm-hmm.
All those deals have already been cut. The problems that remain are problems where the Democratic interest group that stands in the way are the core demands of the Democrats. There is nothing more that the teachers' unions care about than protecting teachers from being fired, okay? Yet that is the key thing you have to do to achieve education reform. You're not going to be able to bridge that gap by compromising. You need triangulation that tells the unions, stuff it, we're achieving this reform, we're going to steamroll over you. And we're not going to negotiate with you and give you half the incompetence stay. We demand this reform, and you have to be sort of negative about it, and that's the virtue of triangulation over bridge building. And the other thing is triangulation in that respect has broad bipartisan appeal. So it is a way to bridge, to build a bipartisan coalition, as Clinton built over welfare, in a way that sort of the standard, what you describe as the Obama sort of let's cut the loaf in half bridge building doesn't accomplish.
You know, we could at this point segue into school vouchers, but that would be a departure from our meticulously arrived at agenda, I guess. And also, you may have more to say about presidential candidates, do you? A lot to say.
Well, there was this ridiculous Edwards thing. Anyway, so I thought the Obama speech didn't you know, was impressive.
Anyway, it played pretty well in Iowa, and it's looking, his stock is up a little. Obama's stock is up a little, right?
Yes, but Edwards' stock is surprisingly not going down, at least in some polls in Iowa. And it's possible that Hillary will finish third there.
That would really hurt, wouldn't it?
You would think. Edwards.
When is Iowa, by the way?
Except it still might hurt Edwards to finish second. But
I would think. But when is Iowa?
Iowa's January 3rd.
Oh, man.
We don't know when New Hampshire is, but we think it's 5 days later.
Oh, man. Let's talk about this later.
But anyway, Edwards had this ridiculous thing where he said he was going to take away Congress's health care if Congress didn't pass a health care bill for everybody. The only problem is he has no power to take away Congress's health care. And he's being widely ridiculed for this.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it'll... I don't suppose you want to defend him.
Healthcare?
Edwards' ridiculous phony boast.
His phony what?
Edwards' ridiculous phony threat to take away Congress's healthcare.
No, I don't want to get into that. You're okay. Right. But I like this Giuliani thing with Judith Regan. Is that her name? The way
yes.
She's putting the pedal to the metal on this Bernard Carrick thing, right?
Yes, that's fun to watch.
Yeah. I mean, I think I did... for those who haven't been paying attention, you know, she is his Carrick's former lover. And I think, to my credit, many moons ago, I said, to me, the weirdest thing about Giuliani is the whole Carrick thing. And... You know, Carrick is, of course, you know, he was his police commissioner. Giuliani foisted him on Bush as the Homeland Security Director.
Well, this is the problem with Giuliani. He had a very good police commissioner named, you know, Bratton, who is now here in Los Angeles.
But he was getting too much credit, so
he
Giuliani...
He was getting too much credit and too big for his britches, so Giuliani got rid of him and got somebody who was more loyal.
Yeah.
That's a very bad way to run a White House.
Well, and also loyal. Have you ever noticed that everyone about whom it is said he's... A really loyal guy is an asshole. Have you ever noticed that? They said that about Frank Sinatra, right? Which wasn't even true. I mean, he turned on Peter Lawford like, you know, like that. But they're all thugs. People who are praised for their loyalty tend to be thugs.
I'm not an expert in Rat Pack politics. I didn't know about that.
Oh, yeah. After Peter Lawford, it had to do with the Kennedys icing Sinatra out of the circle because Bobby Kennedy was concerned about the mob ties, and I think Lawford delivered the news and was kind of the fall guy or something, and Sinatra like never spoke to him again or something. But anyway, I digress. But I forget what I digress.
You're saying
from.
That all people who are loyal are jerks.
Yeah, I wouldn't go quite that far. But people who are famously loyal tend to be thugs. I mean, loyalty, when you think about it, is not especially commendable virtue if taken too far. You shouldn't be loyal to someone under all circumstances. They might turn out to be genocidal or something. What?
But that's true. But what about King Juan Carlos of Spain, who was loyal to Franco, and that worked out okay?
Just the counterexample I was thinking about, Mickey.
I mean, it's so obvious. I mean, it's just sitting
yeah,
out
it's,
there.
It was, yeah. How did I miss that? But okay, back to Carrick. So now he's been indicted, and Judith Regan is saying what? That Rupert Murdoch, basically, or people at Murdoch's company were pressuring her to keep things quiet lest Giuliani be embarrassed?
Well, I believe that.
I believe it, too.
I believe anything of Fox.
I do, too. And just to sum up my feeling, I mean... Giuliani, he just can't win. If he didn't know that Carrick was kind of corrupt and sleazy, that's an indictment of him, okay? You should know your police commissioner, and if he didn't, how is he going to have a clean cabinet? How is he going to run a clean administration? And, of course, if he did know, that's an indictment of Giuliani. And
right.
And what's your guess? I suspect Giuliani basically did know, and this is the kind of thing that Giuliani really doesn't mind much.
I think it's my guess is he didn't know. But I hear from people who've worked for him that he's a fairly, straight arrow.
Actually, I heard at one of my many Washington coffee outings that there may be a little story coming down the pipeline contrary to that thesis, Mickey.
About corruption?
Let's just say I reserve the right to say I told you so.
I would believe sex. I wouldn't believe corruption.
This ain't sex. I have nothing more to say right now.
God, you're worse than me.
I know, except that it's not about sex. That's the difference between me and you.
This would
be actual significant news reflecting on someone's actual performance in office.
Hey, John Edwards is running on what a fine, loyal husband he is. Okay?
For all I know, he is.
If that rumor is true, it goes to the core of his candidacy.
For all I know, he is.
So there. Well, that'll be interesting, Bob. Thanks for that teaser.
Yeah, do what you can to fan the flames of that rumor, will you?
This is one of the things where I am more interested in Democratic scandals than Republican scandals. Because as Nora Ephron says, they are the people I wouldn't date anyway. So, I'm not interested in Republicans.
Okay.
Pakistan?
What? Pakistan? I don't know. Do you have anything to say about Pakistan?
Well, just that there are a variety of,
Wait a second. First of all, what's the latest thing we know about? I'm in this news blackout. I did glance at the actual physical copy of the newspaper this morning, and at this point, Musharraf was kind of dissing the Bush administration, which wants him to end emergency rule before the election, and he's saying screw you to Condi, basically. Is that the latest?
I don't know if that's the latest. And he's having a back and forth with Budo, who was sort of trying to have it both ways by being the loyal opposition, yet holding out the possibility of once again sharing power with him. There's a variety of sort of phony, obviously phony solutions to this, one of which is that somehow the lawyers are going to lead, we should side with the lawyers, and that they're somehow going to lead Pakistan on the right path. The problem with it is, it's not even that the middle class is united against Musharraf, because apparently the economy has prospered dramatically under Musharraf, so the actual bourgeoisie of businessmen are pretty happy with Musharraf.
Well, what about these lawyers? They're
well, they're, you know, how many of the lawyers are there? I mean, you know, there's not even the middle class is even tiny in Pakistan. The lawyers are a tiny part of the middle class.
Yeah, but the assumption is that he would actually lose the election, right? That's why he's doing this stuff.
No, I don't think that's the assumption is the election was unconstitutional because you can't be the head of the military and run for office at the same time.
Well, yeah, but he's not even willing to just have the election now. The plan was he was going to step down from the military, I think, but have the election and run for office still, right? And but he refuses to even do that and relax the state of emergency in advance. There must be a reason he's afraid to.
Well, but he
doesn't want to let his political opponents out of jail before the election. To me, that's a sign that you're not overwhelmingly confident of your prospects.
Well, it might mean that you don't want to have a bunch of commotion before the election. The other phony solution was a neocon solution, which is, you know, the key moment in the Reagan administration was when Paul Wolfowitz convinced him to go against Marcos, that Marcos was not an indispensable dictator, and to back Corazon Aquino, who was the voices of the force of freedom and democracy. It's not clear that the freedom and democracy would carry the day. B, the Philippines didn't have nuclear weapons and didn't have Al-Qaeda camped out in a third of their country.
Yeah, but you know.
I just don't see how the Corazon Aquino solution works here.
Yeah, but I mean, look. I mean, this is you commonly hear this. Okay, we have to back up. We have all these reasons for helping to prop up dictators, and I really think we should subject them to systematic review on a case by case basis. Because I think you go across the board, and the rationales just don't hold up as well as people say. This is a good example. Okay. Oh, we should prop this guy up because they've got nuclear weapons, and so we have to stay on good terms. And that's certainly been the position. I mean, we stayed on good terms with Zia, a dictator. We stayed on good terms, I guess, with, like, Bhutto, who was more democratically legitimate but was kind of corrupt, or at least her family was or something. Okay. So we've been on good terms with these guys. What have they been doing? They've been giving the world, you know, everything they need to build nuclear weapons. They have single-handedly done their best to make sure that the axis of evil has nuclear weapons. I don't get how this is. And also, I don't know that we have much confidence that the nuclear arms are very secure right now and not falling into terrorist hands.
Bhutto's not a good example for you, Bob, because I think Bhutto was about as democratic elected as we're going to get. And if that didn't do the job, then that's not really a good case for democracy.
But my point is, I don't know the exact timetable of the AQ-Con thing or how many administrations it spanned, but some of them were dictatorships we were helping to prop up, I think. And in any event, we just didn't know. It really didn't matter what kind of terms we were on with the government.
It seems to me the key, actually, the nuclear weapons thing may be a bit of a red herring.
Well, what's your other thing? Oh, well, Al Qaeda.
The main herring is the real herring is Al Qaeda.
Yeah, but wait. Our sponsorship of Musharraf definitely adds some fuel to Al Qaeda. Now, it may be that the alliance. Also, and I don't know enough about the nuts and bolts of how it helps us fight Al-Qaeda or how we coerce them into fighting Al-Qaeda, if we really do. That's all like a black box, and I don't think I've ever encountered anybody who claimed to have a clear understanding of that. But I am sure that on the one hand, the fact that Musharraf seems to be our stooge is of recruiting value to the radicals in that part of Pakistan.
Well, but Bob, the problem is that Musharraf sends his army. The army is sort of an independent institution in Pakistan.
So they claim.
I assume, like it is in Turkey, it stands of itself alone. Musharraf, as head of the army, sends the army into Waziristan to go after Al Qaeda. Entire brigades surrender to Al Qaeda without a shot because they don't have the will to fight, and they're captured immediately. Okay.
By Al Qaeda.
By the Al Qaeda allied locals in Waziristan.
So what good is our alliance with Musharraf doing?
Well, but what good is any alliance if, as long as the army continues to surrender, no alliance is good.
Well, okay.
And certainly Benazir Bhutto, the army isn't going to die for her.
Well, what does it matter if it's already totally ineffectual? Why should we stand by this guy?
Well, because there's a big offensive about to start, apparently, and I think he has at least one more shot at getting it right.
Mickey, that is the most pathetic argument. You just conceded that if you look at nuclear weapons and Al-Qaeda, the guy is 0-2. Our whole principle of standing by dictators on those two grounds are, in this case, it's 0-2. I mean,
well, it's hard to stop nationalist aspirations for nuclear weapons. You know that.
Whatever the reason, our policy has not succeeded, it hasn't succeeded. Why are we standing by this guy?
Because it just seems to me, all these other solutions seem like obvious losers.
Like what? What's wrong?
Well, like the idea that a Corazon Aquino is going to come along and somehow clear out Waziristan. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, but see, Mickey,
like the idea that the lawyers are going to clear out Waziristan.
Mickey,
that's not going to happen.
That is the problem, is this whole attitude that we need to think up, okay, the specific regime we do want installed and get them installed, and then you just can't control everything. And sometimes, and in fact, our record of trying to control things in various countries is mixed at best and arguably on balance negative. And I'm suggesting that the best policy may be one that is largely one of principle, which is in a situation like this to say, look, it's not for us to pick the next leader, but we think these lawyers are on the side of right, and not continue to pour tons of money into Musharraf and just say, we don't know what's going to happen in Pakistan. We do not have control of it. But we hope that, these people who seem to be on the side of right win.
So you would cut off the military aid? To punish Musharraf?
I doubt I would do it all of a sudden, but would I start phasing it out? Yeah. I mean, it's totally unclear to me that this has been a net asset for us. It really is. Now, maybe if I knew more about the facts on the ground, I would be persuaded. But from what I read in the papers...
That was a very Hillary-esque answer, Bob.
What?
That was a very Hillary-esque answer. You'd phase it out.
Well, I know. I could be president, I've long said that I had political potential, but it's too late for a big career change.
Well...
Look, I don't know that. I don't know anything. I mean, if anything I said seemed to convey the claim that I actually know anything about Pakistan.
Well, I don't either, but it just seemed to me that all these demands of Musharraf, that he take off the uniform, that he hold elections, are sort of... I don't think we have that option at the moment. We have to give him a chance to go after Al-Qaeda.
Well, see, I in a certain sense, I agree, because I think... The whole business of making demands, even when he complies, that just reinforces the image that he's our puppet, And I'm saying that's part of the problem. That it's really bad for the perception of us, that we go around selecting these pawns. And by the way, Bhutto is viewed as an American pawn, too, and she's not especially popular.
But if we cut off aid, don't you think that would enrage them, too?
Enrage who?
The Pakistanis will say that some friends of these Americans are when... when the going gets rough, they just cut off aid to save money. Well, you know, that's not going to win us a whole lot of friends.
Like I said, before you accuse me of being Hillary-esque, I'm not saying I would do it overnight, but you could also redeploy it so it was not it was not direct aid to the military or something. I don't know. I'm just saying I think we should this whole business of trying to micromanage the events within these authoritarian countries seems to me, by and large, not to work and often to be counterproductive. I mean, it's like you look at Saudi Arabia and Egypt and so on. I mean, you know, it's interesting. As I understand it, when radical Islam started to really crystallize in the mid-20th century, you know, the big enemy was not us. It was like these authoritarian states. And granted, these radicals were not Democrats. They didn't want democracy. But the fact is, their enemy was the near enemy, you know, the dictators who weren't letting them do their thing. And the way we got drawn into it was by supporting dictators, you know, or being seen as cozying up to dictators. You know, is that a net plus? And there we get into a different subject, which is, you know, how likely is it really that if we are not on good terms with all these oil dictators, we would stand in danger of losing access to oil?
Well,
I think that's a total myth.
Access to oil is a justification for cozying up to dictators, or fighting communism is a justification, seem weak. Nuclear weapons and al-Qaeda seem strong.
Nuclear weapons is a good one if it works. Pakistan is a case where it manifestly has not worked.
Well, they haven't blown anything up in our vicinity.
No, they just gave them to North Korea. And, well, I mean, I think ultimately if you trace, I think it's the case that if you trace North Korea, Iran, and maybe Iraq's nuclear weapons programs to their source, I think Pakistan plays a role in all of them. Is that?
Could well be. There was a book written about it. There's a very good column by a guy named Greenaway in the Boston Globe that I'll link to. That refers to a scholar named Jessica Stern at Harvard. Have you heard of her?
I know her slightly.
She apparently has written something about why democracies are sometimes the worst of both worlds when it comes to fighting terrorism. Be good to have her on. She might actually know what she's talking about.
Would be, but that would be a precedent we'd have to ponder before setting, I think.
Well, it wouldn't cut into our audience.
We have our niche of...
Our niche is just invective and making fools of ourselves.
No, I just find it threatening, the idea of somebody knowing what they're talking about. I don't know. Maybe we should do it.
We'll get to something later where you, in theory, know what you're talking about.
Oh, that's
about.
Right. Let's get there quick. Should we pass through Iraq first? You'll do your... I don't know that we'll disagree. I mean, things are getting better in Iraq, right?
Things are getting better in Iraq. If you read the Anderson piece in The New Yorker and an informed comment, you're convinced that it's pretty fragile. We're arming these awakening councils and various Sunni brigades. We don't really know what they're up to. Sometimes they suck up to us during the day and then they become death squads at night. They may just be arming themselves for a future civil war. They may not be. But all this, it seems to me the greater danger is that we will leave in a hurry without either vetting these groups or letting them settle in and become become addicted to peace. And that leads me to be very worried about the Democratic candidates who, with the exception of Hillary, seem to be in favor of a precipitous withdrawal from Iraq. If American casualties are down to a relatively tolerable level, 39 a month is, it seems to me it's worth staying in Iraq to attenuate the process of, you know, this fragile, violent, unsatisfactory process of accommodation, and making sure that it's as little violent as possible, and also to steer it subtly in the direction we want it to go. And if you even Obama, certainly Edwards and Richardson, if you believe them, they're just going to throw it all out the window in a precipitous march for the exits, and that seems to be troubling.
Well, there's a second troubling thing about it, if you ask me, which is the politics of it and the message that ultimately gets sent. I mean, we said, I think many months ago, that a danger of the Democrats putting a lot of emphasis on withdrawal as a political objective at around the time the surge was starting was that it was changing the subject from the question of whether the Iraq War had been a good idea about which, you know, any you know, the left is definitely right. You know, the war was a bad idea. That debate you win, and they were changing the subject to will the surge work or seem to work. And certainly it can now be cast as seeming to work, whatever arguments you want to have about what the real sources of improvement are. So one thing that bothers me is that this has indeed played out so that hawks can change the subject from the question of whether the war was a good idea, which I think the fundamental lesson we need to take home from this was bad idea, change the subject to, you know, oh, the Democrats were wrong again. They thought we couldn't, you know, tough it out. And look, we toughed it out. And, of course, they'll also try to pass this off as...
Well, they'll be right about that, won't they?
What?
They'll be right that it was a good thing to tough it out.
Well, they'll certainly be right that... I mean, probably, yeah. I mean, compared to... yeah, I think probably they will, but they'll certainly be right to say the Democrats who specifically... Well, we don't know for sure how it's going to play out. Looks like now they will be right to say... The Democrats who predicted that, you know, the war would never wind down and it was going to be the apocalypse and we might as well get out now. It's looking now like they may be able to argue that those Democrats were wrong. And this is one thing that worried me.
But I hope they'll be able to argue that, because that would mean that the outcome was relatively tolerable. The question is, will they be argue that this vindicates Bush and the war was a good idea? And even
they're going to try to conflate those two issues now.
Right, that's true, and they're already trying that. But keep in mind a couple things. First, the public seems dead set against that idea at the moment. So it's mainly right wing op-ed writers, not the public, who agrees with that. Second, as the more successful the surge is, and the more Iraq recedes from the headlines. That sort of benefits the Democrats, because on domestic issues, it seems to me, they win. And once the threat of war recedes, Bush doesn't have his weapon of fear, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't need a Giuliani to lead us in the war on terror, because the war on terror is on the back burner.
No, I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong. I mean, I think the fear of terrorism is, to a large extent, independent of the existence of the Iraq war. There are going to be terrorist attacks around the world. There will probably be some, you know, there will be at least, if nothing else, foiled homegrown attacks over the next year. There may be some successful small-scale ones. I hope they won't be successful large-scale ones. I think it'll be easy to keep the fear of terrorism alive regardless of the Iraq war.
But it won't be anything like it was after 9/11. It won't be what Giuliani needs necessarily to win. It won't necessarily eclipse national health care.
Well, it's a total wild card. I think there's a fairly good chance that, and I think, but here's the irony, okay? If you ask, why do I think it's likely that there's enough support for homegrown terrorism for at least some minor league, small-scale homegrown attack to work, the answer is the Iraq War. That's what I think. And I think that's been the huge cause, one of the huge costs of the Iraq War, is to make homegrown terrorism more likely in a way that will be hard to trace to the Iraq War. You know, those are lines of causality that'll be hard to trace. So what you'll see, if I'm right, you know, if you see some little act of homegrown terrorism, Giuliani will say, I told you so, when in fact it may well be an exact contradiction of his claim that he's right,
true.
Because it will be something that the Iraq War brought us.
I agree with that, Bob, but the question is, is it better, just on crass political terms, is it better for the Democrats or worse if the Iraq war sort of recedes from the headlines on a relatively, you know, better than epic chaotic disaster level?
And
I've always taken the position, along with Bruce Reed, that that's good for the Democrats. And that was a convenient position for me to take. But I sort of think it's true, because when the country's not on a war footing, Democrats do better.
I think if the Democrats had not staged that attempt to secure a withdrawal legislatively, even though they kind of backed out in the end. But if they had not been identified with that position, and if there had not been so much of that kind of rhetoric that, you know, we withdraw or it's the apocalypse, I think you would probably be right. As it is, I actually think you're wrong.
I don't think I actually am taking a perverse position for me. I don't think that's going to hurt the Democrats if they stop it. For the Democrats to have said the surge isn't going to work, we should withdraw now. Even if the surge works, you know, I actually I think people will say, well, the only reason they did the surge was because the Democrats were putting pressure on them.
I don't think the average voter thinks nearly in that.
I don't feel in my guts that people will hold that foolish position, and it was foolish, position against the Democrats. But maybe I'm crazy.
Well, my longstanding position is certainly that you're crazy, so...
Yeah, okay. Well, this falls under that general rubric.
So we settled that in a kind of deductive fashion.
You had some violent reaction to the discussion of school vouchers.
Yeah, just quickly. Mark Schmidt and Megan McArdle had this voucher debate on Blogging Heads. And just while watching it, there were these anti-voucher arguments welling up within me that I felt the need to expel. And I know you're kind of a voucher defender. And it's not so much...
I'm a choice defender.
Well, okay. Well, this is a major form of choice. The other form being charter schools.
Right, but you can have vouchers, but they have to take all comers. They can't just be, they have to accept the voucher as full tuition. So you can't just let rich people add on $10,000 more.
Say that part again. That might neutralize one of my arguments. How does that go?
In other words, you don't want to give a $5,000 voucher to every student and then have rich people able to add another $5,000. So you're basically offering a $5,000 subsidy for a school that charges $10,000 and the poor people don't get into it.
That's surely going to happen, though. There's no way rich people are going to buy into a system that doesn't permit them to supplement. I guess what you're saying is take it or leave it. You're saying take it with the strings or leave it and pay for all the tuition yourself?
Right. The rich people have already opted out of the system. Certainly on the west side of Los Angeles, the rich don't go to public school anymore. So the only question is the people who are in the public school and a few people on the fringes who might be coaxed back into the public schools if they were better, would a limit of $7,000 a student create a system where they might send their kids to school? And I think it would, even for rich people, even if they couldn't add another $5,000 to it.
You are so wrong.
people don't like paying $15,000 a year to send their kids
so
to elementary
wrong.
School.
I mean, rich, even upper middle class people, increasingly, parents will saw off their own limbs to increase by 1% the chance of their kid getting into the college of their choice.
Well, right, but it might help. It might help them get into college if they go to a public school.
Well, I think my basic position is that there's no way the politics would work out such that poor people actually were given a lot of money to play with and wind up at a good private school. The same politics that prevent us from doing federal financing from equalizing the funding in the first place via a lot of federal financing are going to keep us from giving poor people a lot of money through vouchers. We just don't, we're just not going to give poor people a lot of money one way or the other.
But what the question isn't, are poor people going to get to go to great schools that rich people go to? The question is, are poor people who are now trapped in these horrible urban school districts going to get a school system that's a lot better than the one they have?
Right.
And it seems to me if you allow choice and charters and let them choose between schools and exercise the power of exit as they were as they were talking about in that Blogging Heads dialogue, you're going to get a better school system.
So you actually listened to that, huh? Or did you watch the part of the New York Times?
I listened to about half of it.
Yeah.
It was not an efficient way to get information.
Well, video is not. It's the histrionics that we tune into video for.
Right, right. Well, anyway, I thought they were too timid. They were both admitting that 90% of the kids are going to go to the public school system. Why? Why can't you blow up the public school system and have 100% of the kids go to charter schools?
Megan is fine with blowing up the public school system.
That's actually sort of happening in Los Angeles. The charter movement is growing very rapidly. It's actually about to take over some high schools.
But those are publicly financed schools, right?
Well, but at some point, if you have a school financed by a $5,000 voucher or a school financed directly by $5,000, the distinction becomes a little academic. The question is it a new school where they can have flexible rules, where they can be punished by exit if they fail, where they're not in the death grip of the teachers' unions, and where the consumers of education have the choice and the ability to, if you don't attract the parents, your school dies and goes away. Who cares if it's a voucher or a charter?
Well, in closing, I would say a couple of things. One is the concern often expressed is for, you know, the worst of the worst, the people in the very worst public schools, the worst students in the worst public schools, whatever. Well, if you look at those students, I mean, a fair amount of the time, their problems begin with their home life and their parents. It's not clear, A, that their parents would make a judicious choice if given the resources. B, I don't think as a political matter their parents are going to have the resources for reasons that I just spelled out. I think as a political reality, the system you're going to wind up with is one where the vouchers are available to the middle class and they're free to supplement them. And what that's going to do is destroy the middle class public school system, because people are going to peel off one by one, and support for the local tax base, even for the public schools, is going to erode, and it's just going to destroy the whole system. So,
well, you want to start off with the poor. I agree with that. But the argument against what you're saying is that is the supermarket argument, that some people are stupid shoppers, but they get good vegetables when they go to the supermarket because all the people who are good shoppers force the supermarkets into carrying good vegetables, so that the people who are poor shoppers, like me, are free riders on the good shopper.
Yeah, but you got to have money to even get the good vegetables, and I'm predicting that won't happen. But that's, you may be right about the wisdom of the choices that most of them would make.
I mean, if the charter people take over Locke High School, they're going to spend the same amount of money on Locke High School. It's just going to be run by a group that is accountable if they fail. I was very glad that they couched it in terms of exit versus voice, because it does, based on this famous Albert Hirschman book.
Right.
There are two ways to influence large organizations. One is to stay and make your objections known. That's voice. The other is to leave. That's exit. Seems to me it's always easier, you know, it's always easier to not go to a restaurant than to teach the chef how to cook. That's a much more effective way of getting good restaurants. Same with schools. I know of no instance where voice was more effective at changing the institution than exit. Sometimes if you have a lot of exit,
the remaining institution
gets worse, but you know, that might be an argument for total exit.
Well, voice plays a role in middle class and affluent neighborhoods, I think, where you have, you know, engaged parents in public school. I think they can make a big difference.
It does.
They play less of a role in low income neighborhoods.
In terms of turning around a completely screwed up organization, exit is more effective, I think.
Although I would also say, from my experience with my kids in public school, that your constant harping on teachers' unions and the need to be able to fire teachers more readily is not nearly the whole problem. I mean, when you see bad schools, what you see time and again is they have a bad principal who has made bad hiring decisions. And being able to fire the teachers wouldn't help, because this principal just doesn't do a good job of judgment in the first place.
What if the principal is fired and they appoint you to take charge? If you can't fire the teachers, then you're stuck with Principal One's bad hiring choices.
You're saying the principal should be more readily fired, or?
And the teachers. If a new good principal comes in, he should be able to fire the bad principal's bad choices.
Yeah, but what I've seen a shortage of in the public school system is, well, two things. Good principals, and there is a bias in terms of spending away from human resources, kind of. It's like whenever there's a big school bond, they want to build the new, most modern gymnasium, and that's just not the most crying need that the school has.
Well, I deny that your kids go to a failed inner-city school system. I bet they go to a school system in a leafy academic suburb.
They may, but I also have experience in Washington, D.C. Granted, this was supposed to be one of the best elementary schools in Washington, D.C., and now I think it really is, because there's been a change of principal, Lafayette Elementary School. But it was actually pretty bad, and the principal's horrible. Horrible. And half of the teachers were horrible as a result.
There was actually some blog discussion of Lafayette. I think it may have been charterized. Is that possible?
Well, Mark Schmidt's kid, I think, now goes to Lafayette. I just think they changed the principal. It makes a world of difference.
Okay. Anyway, the second point about spending on infrastructure, that's what I thought. You know, here in Los Angeles, we have, like, the biggest public works project in the history of mankind. We're building hundreds and hundreds of new schools to accommodate a wave of immigrants that now will probably never show up.
I knew this would come back to him.
But
you're worried that they won't show up.
No, but
it's a good thing. No, pleasing you on immigration, Mickey.
Hear me out. It's a good thing, because I was talking to an education expert the other day. The big roadblock to founding new charter schools is physical space. It's hard to get the buildings for them. No, parents don't, you know, homeowners don't want a school, a charter school opening next door. So by building all these schools we don't need, we are enabling an effective choice movement, because there'll be all these buildings that we can then lease out to charter schools, and we can have hundreds of charter schools. So infrastructure isn't a crazy thing to spend money on.
Maybe right, but I'll tell you, they could definitely shift some resources in the direction of, I mean, our teachers are pretty highly paid here, quite highly paid, but I'd rather see more of them with smaller class size.
When people advocate choice, they're not thinking of your children.
That's true. Or me. My family is off of their radar screen. So, you know, we're like 55 minutes into this, and I want to talk about viewer comments at some point. Are you sure we want to get into group selection?
We can put that off till next time.
We can put that off.
I think the human species will still be evolving next time.
I think so.
Although it's 2 weeks away. That's a long time in evolutionary terms.
You never know what will happen in the gene pool between now and then.
Okay.
We could give them a little taste. Oh, I'm curious as a tease. What is it that you're interested in? I mean, you pointed me...
Well, in your book, yeah. The Moral Animal, which I'm holding up here...
Oh, good.
You piss all over the idea of group selectionism.
Not quite true.
You say, so even though a tribe full of selfless people would prevail over a tribe full of selfish people,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to see how a tribe would be full of selfless people in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that... selection always occurs at the level of the individual. It's not that you do something for the good of the group.
I absolutely don't say always.
And yet, the worm has turned, Bob.
Now,
and my impression is that the scientific conventional wisdom is now that this passage in The Moral Animal is leading readers in the wrong direction. Group selection is back. And I was wondering what the political implications of that were. It seems to me there was some reason why we didn't like group selection. And if group selection is coming back, is that a good thing or a bad thing in terms of the political implications of Darwinism?
Well, you,
not just
you're kind of luring
right
me into this discussion, but it's such a long discussion.
Well, we can tease it. You can just say it will all be explained.
Yeah, but now I it's hard for me to muster the self-restraint to let what you just said stand without challenge.
Was there a short, pithy rant like your rant about the Iraq War?
From several dialogues ago, you mean? Well, no. I mean, see,
okay.
The thing is, most people have no idea what we're talking about, right? Group selection,
okay.
Individual
right.
selection.
Okay, so we'll do it later when we'll actually
okay.
give people
okay, so you've thrown down the gauntlet. I would say, if you look elsewhere in my book, The Moral Animal, you'll see I don't say that group selection can't happen. I explicitly say it can happen. And I guess I'll leave it at there, and people can wonder how I'm going to dig myself out of the hole you seem to have put me in.
Cool.
But it is all about... Well, the debate should reflect on human nature, the sources of altruism, how good are we, how good aren't we, and there are these supposed political implications.
Well, I don't know what they are. I'm just curious.
I will say that the blog post you sent me to is about them. What was this person's name?
I think his name was Wilson.
No. But the blog post was written by Dan Agin, A-G-I-N.
Oh, no.
And I started, copying and pasting every sentence that I thought contained a misconception, and I wound up just having, the whole article. One by one, I had pasted the whole thing in. So I would not use that as a reliable guide to the landscape.
I guess I was sending too many for the link. Anyway.
Although you seem to have used it as a template.
No. Anyway... people won't understand what the hell we're talking about. So.
No, I know. We lost them a long time ago. Well, let's talk about some house...
And the people that do understand it will think we don't know what we're talking about. So.
They're wrong. They're half right. Okay. Well, first of all, this may be a solemn moment, Mickey. You know why?
You're stepping down as head of Blogging Heads and you're being replaced by Judith Regan.
That's correct. No, that's not right. It is. I know I've made these kinds of noises before, but I really do think this may be the last time people see us surrounded by the sacred sea of Blogging Heads Green. There will be the Blogging Heads Green in the new design, but it won't be a C. It won't be. We won't be awash in it. Yeah. I'm sorry to say.
I'm sure that's a big deal.
It's a very emotional moment for me. And I, you know.
Our, the sole virtue of our design is it's so ugly that nobody would ever copy it.
It has not been widely emulated. You make a good point.
You may be in danger of making it actually.
Although the Dialog itself is increasingly emulated. We were ahead of the pack there, weren't we?
You're ahead of the pack, but I believe you failed to capitalize on your early adopter status.
I predict that the next 3 months will prove you wrong.
Okay.
That's a bold prediction.
You got the New York Times, Lake. That's cool.
We do have the New York Times thing. Tip of the iceberg. We have this whole strategy laid out. You'll see.
Is Ron Burkle buying you?
No, I've been told if you associate with him, you'll wind up in a theoretical scandal. So, comments. Okay, first of all, you know, Nate, Nate was last seen, running from the group of thugs we had sent down to Arkansas. He's now in another state. He's the Blogging Heads historian and archivist. And he started a Wikipedia entry, Blogging Heads entry, and there was some lamenting in the comments section that I had not lauded him for that, I think, in our last Dialog.
Wasn't the Wikipedia entry sort of one of those tentative ones they were threatening to squash at a minute?
No, that's a separate matter. Apparently, right. They've been threatening to squash Dialog as an entry.
Well, nobody likes Dialog, Blob. You're the only person who persists in that.
No, it's perfectly natural. The word vlog already existed. What do you get when you get two people? Vlog was like a monovlog, okay? When you put two people together, dia, right, and then it happens to sound like dialogue, what's wrong with that?
It's perfectly logical. It just doesn't. It's not a pretty word, and the dogs don't like it.
Well, I will say
you
one thing.
Can't make people use it.
I will say one thing. If any of our loyal followers are out there making the argument in Wikipedia that the word deserves to stay, it now appears on the New York Times website at the end of all our videos. I mean, short of the Oxford English Dictionary, what greater affirmation is there for a word?
It is. Well,
it's a serious point. It's the New York Times.
It's hard to come up with a substitute word.
Yeah, there's that, and there's the fact that the New York Times has sanctified it.
How about web dialogue? Video chat? I don't know. It seems to me there's probably a better word.
Well, why don't you come up with it?
Then a
meanwhile,
word. Okay.
We will be fighting to the last man or woman in the Wikipedia fray.
I'm not going to die for Dialog.
You like Dingolink, though, right?
I love Dingolink.
Well?
Dingolink is a keeper.
Well, okay. Let's fight for that one, too.
Is that under threat?
I don't know. Haven't seen it on the New York Times yet. It'll get there.
Okay. Moving right along.
The other thing is just, I think, we should have a conservative commenter appreciation day.
I'm all for that.
What?
I'm all for that.
Yeah, because, I think our conservative commenters sometimes feel perhaps outnumbered, if not persecuted and harassed. I mean, there was a Dialog recently in which, Passivorous, in the comments section, and he's conservative, people are criticizing him for kind of lacking decorum and being, even outright, crude and mean and impolite was the accusation. But if you look at the way this played out, I've got to say, he was not necessarily, the first to strike. Here's what happens, okay? There was this Dialog that, as it happens, appeared on Veterans Day, and he thought the tone was inappropriate for Veterans Day. So I think this was the very first comment. Passivorous says, "Nice choice of Dialoggers for Veterans Day, Mr. Wright. Wrong." Okay, so there was that little, witticism.
Right.
A legitimate thing to say. He could have possibly said it more diplomatically, but I'm fine with that. But then the next comment in response to him from Lowellfield was, "Go back to LGF," and I think LGF stands for Little Green Footballs, the right-wing blog.
Yeah.
Okay, "go back to LGF, you little fascist." Period. Okay? Then after that, Pacivarus, you know, said some things in a less than totally civil fashion, and he was attacked for it. And I would just point out that, you know, he wasn't exactly greeted warmly in the first place, right?
Yeah. You're a big, big man to say that, Bob.
Well, I am. I think I think when conservatives evince bitterness and even belligerence, we should look for the root causes.
But,
don't you?
But
unless you think that, or do you think it would be appeasement?
You used to be one of America's great public intellectuals, and now you're spending your entire time immersed in your tiny little fan base of commenters on Blogging Heads.
No, there's a serious point.
This was a danger they warned me about.
No, there's a serious point here. I'm going to switch from sardonic mode to actually serious mode.
I'm bowing my head.
What?
I'm bowing my head.
This is hard, but I'm serious. Our comment section is very unusual in that it truly is, cross-ideological. You actually have arguments that span a fair amount of the ideological spectrum. That is very rare on the Internet, is it not?
It is. There are places like the Volokh conspiracy and Bill Bradley's New West Notes that have very good bipartisan comment sections.
Yeah, and I would guess in the case of Volokh, it has something to do with the way libertarians' relationship to conservatism, right?
Well, they're all law professors and lawyers, and they're
used to arguing. Like to argue, so that's different. I'm serious. You actually see genuinely enlightening debate between conservatives and liberals in our comments section. It works better when it's civil. It is true. I mean, we should be thankful. The conservatives are definitely a minority, but we should be thankful for them. And, shower them with praise and material goods. And I think we should seek the root causes of their bitterness and resentment.
Maybe subsidize them.
Maybe so. Send them transfer payments.
I assume that they're the victims of, the Daily Kos Fight Club culture that Tom McGuire writes about.
Well, see, that is what I would distinguish our comments section from and like it to be very distinct from. You know, genuine, wide-ranging debate conducted in civil fashion.
Yeah. Not that there isn't the Fight Club culture on the right, but it's,
there is on both sides.
There's
the Internet creates that naturally. You have to work to create something different. I'm serious.
This is a precious, fragile ecosystem.
It is. It's not the natural condition of the Internet. The Internet naturally creates preaching-to-the-choir situations. But you could, if you wield the dialogue judiciously, you can try to create a different, an alternative environment.
You're a bridge builder, not a triangulator.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. Now speaking of civil discourse, Wolf Gangus, who's probably not, doesn't evince, unstinting civility in every post, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
But we still, we love all our commenters. But it comes and goes, the civility with Wolf Gangus. But he has reached the 1,000 comment mark. I guess I say he just because, Wolf, I don't know, maybe it could be a she. I'm guessing a he. We laud Wolf Gangus. So I believe, if I'm doing the counting right, he joins Brendan Keefe, Garbage Cowboy, and, of course, Bloggin' Noggin. Maybe, I don't know, I may be wrong. Maybe it's more than four, but I think those four have reached the 1,000 comment plateau.
Do you think this section is encouraging more comments or discouraging people who aren't those people from commenting, from entering the club?
You mean when I mention names?
Yes, all these shout-outs.
Yeah, I maybe shouldn't do that. Because I know after I first mentioned that Bloggin' Noggin had made 1,000, it was shortly after that that Brendan Keefe was implicated in the Balco scandal. That's a joke.
Okay, well, he could sue you for that.
Yeah, no, he could. No, he wasn't. He's not using any performance-enhancing drugs, so far as I know, but God knows he's prolific.
He took steroids so he could comment more on Blogging Heads?
What?
The joke is that he was using steroids so he could comment more?
That was the joke.
Yeah, okay.
How did it go? How did it go over with you? Did that work for you?
Not funny, as we Hollywood professionals say.
Okay. Well, maybe it's time we drew it to a close, though, then.
Okay. Maybe you should get some of those striking writers to come on Blogging.
Somebody suggested we should get some of these showless talk show hosts to come on.
That's what I thought. You should get Rob Long to come on. He's really good, and he has a blog that's he started on, in the middle of the strike that's very good.
Wait, who else mentioned Rob Long to me recently?
And he's a conservative, sort of.
That doesn't exactly answer my question, but it's interesting.
I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe it was Ann Coulter.
That's unlikely.
Okay. Gary Hart. That must be it.
We've come full circle.
Cool.
All right. Next time.
See ya.
See you around.